And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Haglund, how the heck are you?
Holy smokes. I'm great, busier than a one-legged tap dancer. I mean,
and
holy smokes.
And you're maintaining this level of busyness just to stay warm from if what I hear from you is true.
It is the coldest Australia has been in 20 years. Brr, they say. There was snow, a chilly minus 8.7 degrees Celsius.
In Sydney, Australia, a place.
Well, that's actually in Canberra, but that's inland a bit. But Sydney was like at least down to 5 degrees above. That's also chilly.
I was told there would be no math, but that does seem chilly. That seems colder than Los Angeles, and you build Sydney as equivalent to Los Angeles in terms of weather.
I did up until now. So I take it back. It's it's colder because, you know, we get the Antarctic breeze here. You know how that Antarctic breeze flows so much more differently than, you know, the Arctic blast we get from Canada.
I think we really ought to incorporate weather reports into each and every show.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
I mean, the way that I talked about flash flood warnings on the US-1 heading into the Mississippi Delta last week, you talk about the snow patterns in Sydney and around Sydney, Australia. Next week, Tierra del Fuego, and maybe the week after that, your hometown. This week we begin with an email from a loyal listener, perhaps a recent.
We like that.
A recent but now loyal listener. And it is one that pertains directly to last week's show, as it addresses the careers of both Adam West and Roger Moore, two men who we, albeit belatedly, celebrated in what we like to call celebrity deaths. So why don't I get to the email, shall I?
Shall you?
Hello, Phil. It begins, leaving you out of it altogether, Dean.
What the hell? What the hell? Okay, I'm good. You know what? My ego's not attached.
This actually comes from a very good breakfast clubber who spends most of the year, nevertheless, in Chicago. A breakfast club member who lives in Chicago. Wrap your head around that, Dean Haglund. That would be That would be like being a Hollywood podcast host and living in Sydney. It's unimaginable.
It's mind-boggling just in the beginning. Okay.
Hello, Phil. Yet another one of my quick notes that, if unmonitored, may just expand itself to behemoth? Behemoth? How do you pronounce that?
Behemoth.
Yeah, behemoth proportions. I vow to remain vigilant. My focus of this email is edification. I have listened to Chilpack Hollywood Hour number 528, and you have stimulated some long dormant memories. I must implore you to cease and desist. Since it is too late for this broadcast, allow me to purge some tripe from the dustbins of my mind. Oh, who can forget that?
Oh, who can?
Old chestnut, that musical classic, the dustbins of my mind. One, Hooper. 1978. Now, you'll recall, Dean, that this was one of the Adam West performances I really championed on last week's show.
Yes, you did.
Burt Reynolds, when he was at the peak of his movie star box office appeal, he played a stuntman. And I mentioned that Adam West played the star of the movie within the movie. He, this listener, this good breakfast clubber, who, by the way, is, as will be evidenced in this, a true student of cinema, whose knowledge of silent films and silent one-reelers gives you a run for your money, even. So,
wow.
So let me quit wasting time and get to his insights. Hooper, 1978, is also a film I enjoy in general, and Adam West in particular. However, Adam West is not just playing the star of the movie within the movie, entitled The Spy Who Laughed at Danger. He is also playing himself. You may have forgotten that he is referred to in the film as either Adam or as Mr. West. To me, the concept that they are making a multi-million dollar James Bond-like motion picture starring Adam West may just be the funniest joke in the entire film.
That's pretty good.
Isn't it?
I think I'm going to have to watch the old...
Hooper.
The old Hooper once again.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to be looking for that as well. Okay, he went from 1 to B, which in any good breakfast clubber knows is how you footnote these things. It's a long story, and you'll have to come back to the Shrine of Friendship, which I think you plan on doing in order to understand.
I do.
That. B, my personal favorite Roger Moore performance was in the dreadful motion picture Curse of the Pink Panther, 1983. In the film, Ted Wass plays the part of an inept detective searching for the missing Inspector Clouseau, or is that Chief Inspector Clouseau? For long, convoluted reasons that neither the screenwriters nor the audiences cared about, Clouseau has had plastic surgery, and he now resembles actor Roger Moore. I'm going to get back to the email in a moment, and I'm going to point out that this was a huge oversight on my part, because, again, as I mentioned, we had let so long go before remembering these two actors that I didn't do my usual amount of research. And indeed, when this movie came out in 1983, and for those who don't know, after Peter Sellers died, Blake Edwards made what many would call certainly artistically an ill-advised effort to repeatedly keep the Pink Panther franchise alive without Peter Sellers. And, and Curse of the Pink Panther was one of those efforts. And indeed, Roger Moore gets introduced as Inspector Clouseau with plastic surgery. And he is fantastic in it, Dean.
Is he?
I remember seeing this and thinking, oh, my God, this is why you make this movie, only you don't restrict it to a four-minute cameo. You just go ahead and make the Roger Moore Pink Panther movie because he's every bit the equal of Peter Sellers in this role.
You're kidding.
To help keep, this is back to the email, to help keep this four-minute cameo a secret, Moore appears in the film using the alias Turk Thrust the Second. He sends me the link so that I can watch the scene because he thinks that I had not seen it. Oh, he was oh so wrong. But I will forward the link to you, Dean, so that you can maybe talk about this and tell me whether I'm crazy next week. But like I said, I recall Roger Moore being utterly brilliant in this. And he's acting like Peter Sellers pretending to be Roger Moore.
What?
Yes.
That sounds brilliant.
It is brilliant. And as our listener writes, don't let the scene fool you. The rest of the film is not nearly so entertaining. That brings us to his third point, and we went from number one to B to Roman numeral three, for those of you scoring at home. My personal favorite Adam West voice work was on Batman the Animated Series, Beware the Gray Ghost, 1992. We're going for some deep cuts here, ladies and gentlemen.
Holy smokes.
In this episode, we discover that the inspiration for Bruce Wayne to become Batman stems from a television program he watched as a child about a superhero crime fighter called the Gray Ghost. Adam West plays the part of Simon Trent, a once famous and successful actor who, now impoverished due to being typecast as the Gray Ghost, can no longer find work.
The classic.
The episode is most satisfying, and I am proud to have it in my VHS collection. Having a VHS collection, I'm not so proud of. I wish I could send you a link to the entire episode, but by way of a tease, here are links to the first 9 minutes. I will forward those links to you, Dean. The email is signed. More later, I'm sure. Best to you, Maurice. And that comes from Maurice Terenzio. As I said, he resides in Chicago, but he comes out for about 3 months out of each year and joins us weekly at the Breakfast Club. And anybody who's checked out the episodes of my monthly podcast, Los Angeles Breakfast Club on the Air, might just have enjoyed an interview with him and his lovely wife, Diane. Anyway, I thought that was an extraordinary email.
Yes, fantastic. And so insightful. I learned so much, and now I'm extending my list of things I have to watch.
Do you, in fact, have a VHS collection, Dean Haglund?
Well, it's funny you should ask. There is a VH collection sitting back in Los Angeles, gathering dust. However, at one point, you may remember when we shared the offices next to each other at the old location on San Vicente, I went through three boxes of VHS tapes and transferred them all to a couple of hard drives. So wow. A lot of my early collection is now digitized. And I saved a ton of space. Those are two large boxes of VHS tapes that now exist as one tiny hard drive.
Somehow our home-taped VHS collection has grown since getting back from the road trip. And I have been treated the right word, to more Peanuts movies and episodes of Garfield, the animated series, than I ever knew existed.
How?
Well, you just put the tape. There's a player, and the tape goes in, and then you repatch. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Garfield.
Yeah, I don't know. Let's talk about some contemporary, some contemporary television, can we? For just a moment, before we
sure.
roll up our sleeves and get into movies, I have been doing diligent work. I've got such a long list of TV shows to catch up on, not only my usual ones, but so many that I've promised to watch. This week, I actually accomplished the task of binge-watching two entire seasons. One season, season six of Veep, just concluded, and season four of a show I don't know if we've ever really discussed at all, James Spader's The Blacklist.
This
has been a little bit of a guilty pleasure for me. You know that I'm such a big James Spader fan, and I knew I was going to have to watch season four when I realized our good friend David Dean Bottrell was being reunited with James Spader for the first time since The Practice in a guest starring role. But I want to say this about this show, The Blacklist, because it doesn't get much press, and nor should it. We live in a time of what is known as peak television, where television has become the great American novel, as we've discussed before. But
fantastic.
But The Blacklist is a show that owes more to the days of the Rockford Files and the A-Team and Barnaby Jones. You know, the 70s into the early 80s, episodic. Back then, they really wouldn't do a running plot line. That
right.
is something that really speaks to the modern era. But still, it's that kind of create a fun, mysterious, dangerous central
world.
Character, and
right.
and a peerless actor who's perfect for the part. I mean, you think of some of the actors who worked in television. You know, I mean, I've never quite understood how, you know, there was this looking down at TV actors. When you think of, you know, in the 70s, you had guys like James Garner and,
yeah.
You know, Buddy Ebsen. I mean, I know that name doesn't seem to mean much to people anymore because of the Beverly Hillbillies and stuff like that. But that dude was an actor. And,
yeah.
You know, Carl Malden on the streets of San Francisco. So, you know, you had great actors working in TV back in the 70s and before.
Mm-hmm. But
the 70s was really that time where they opened it up. They went out into what seemed like the real world, right? We're not just building mm-hmm. sets on studio back lots.
Right.
There's a certain realism to them, but at the same time, not the real world in any way, shape, or form, not the great American novel, just, I guess we could say, entertainment for entertainment's sake. And
right.
And I must say, I must doff my cap to The Blacklist, which has cast a very nice ensemble of actors, many of whom have really grown into themselves on this show. But I think this is that kind of television, probably as good as it can be done.
Cool. Well, now I have yet to watch this because I don't see it on my list of things I can watch here in Australia.
It's not on the Australian Netflix?
I don't think it is. Otherwise, season four would have showed up as a thing, right?
As a thing.
We do get something here. There is a competing thing called Stan. Stan competes with Netflix, and so if Stan buys a show, Netflix Australia has to remove it by some legal entity. So I believe
there was
it might be on Stan.
And maybe it'll just come after the whole show ends its run before they'll sell it
right.
to those territories. But it is interesting how ratings have changed so much. This is a show that was doing very well in the ratings for a couple years. And then this year it looked like it might be in trouble because it was down to something along the lines of 5 million viewers a week. But then when they added in the numbers of people who were DVRing it and watching it mm-hmm. within the first 7 days, that number more than doubled.
Wow.
So
again,
just another evidence of how time has changed and how few people, even on a popular show like this, are watching it when it airs versus watching it whenever they want to watch it.
Well, exactly. I mean, I can't think of anything that anybody says anymore, oh, I got to rush home. The show starts at 8 and it's Thursday. Like, who would even say that anymore?
Twin Peaks, but that would be me and 300,000 other people. Twin Peaks, a show that when it first aired on ABC, drew 30 million viewers. Twin Peaks, a return on Showtime that is getting all the ink that could possibly be spilt, 300,000 viewers a week. And
wow.
But that's when its first run. Then you have all
right.
their reruns through the week, and you have their on-demand, and you have what apparently a vast majority of Twin Peaks watchers are taking advantage of, the digital episodes online. So,
see.
You know, it's it is a brave, brave new world. Now, the other show that I want to talk about, again, Veep. Season 6 just
yes.
concluded, and I was very relieved, as you know, that they acquitted themselves admirably last year in Season 5, surviving their handover at the top in terms of their creative producer, their showrunner and creator, Armando Iannucci, leaving the show so he could be with his family in England, brought in a new team, and that's a hard thing to do. And they,
for sure,
they acquitted themselves admirably last year, and they combined that with another thing you know firsthand can be a challenge. They combined it with moving the production from the East Coast all the way to the West Coast. Something like
wow.
that can certainly change the tenor of a show, right?
And the lighting and the, you know, particularly if you're outdoor sets and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, winter in Washington, D.C., as played out in front of the House of Pies here in Las Feliz. Yeah. It affects performances. It really does, right? Not just the look, but also performances. Anyway, they, like I said, they handled that, and by the end of last year's season five, they'd found their stride again, and it was really quite an impressive feat. Now, the one thing that I've always said to you whenever you've said to me, well, but does it still feel funny in the wake of everything going on politically in the world? And I keep explaining to you that it's never been a political show, right? It's a workplace comedy.
Right.
And they get enough of the details right in the political world to make you feel like, all right, this might be what it's like. But it's no more about politics than The Offer was about the production of paper. And that's not true anymore. Season six, when she is no longer in office, and there no longer is a workplace, and the entire brilliant ensemble is spread out over many geographical locations, many workplaces, many storylines, and she is an ex-politician who's writing a book, looking at getting her library built. Suddenly, it's a comedy about politics, and it's hilarious. This was their best season ever, and it
what?
Is so biting politically, and she's not in office anymore.
How ironic is that?
Yeah.
Is that ironic?
I don't know, but what a brilliant choice for them to completely mix it up, to ask themselves, wouldn't it be interesting to see what a still young, still energized former politician might do post White House, and while totally mixing it up in terms of the narrative structure, then also saying, and you know what? Let's make politics be the source of the comedy.
That's fantastic. Well, now I want to see this.
This is incredible. But here's the thing, and this was said to me, this is absolutely true. To be able to appreciate the brilliance of what they did this year really does require seeing every season before it. Because these performers, and especially a Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who gets healthier and healthier looking as a woman with each passing year, and this is a nifty trick, and she does so while more fully and fully embodying a character that is 100% toxic with no redeeming characteristics whatsoever. Can you imagine that there's very few actors that have it in them, have built up their own inner resources enough to wade fully into 100% toxicity and to come out as human beings, as the actors playing them, healthier than they went in. It's something to witness.
Yeah, that is good. I'm perplexed on how that's done, actually. How would you do that?
It is a very, very challenging trick. And I'm not going to say that everyone on that show pulls that particular trick off, but Julia Louis-Dreyfus does. So that's what I want to do. I'm sure I'll have a report with you when you're here about a couple more shows that I'm binge watching. What have you been watching? I know you've been getting ready for the show, but is there any TV you've been watching before we move to the big screen?
Well, you know, as I said, I have embraced on fulfilling my bet, my lost bet. I have actually watched the first 8 episodes of the original 1990 Twin Peaks.
Oh, my God. That's season one. I think you've watched all of season one.
Did it end? Because, well, they didn't solve the crime yet. I thought it was the season ender, too.
No, they don't solve the crime until well into... You mean who killed Laura Palmer? They don't solve that until well into season two,
Oh.
Unless you saw the theatrical release of the film at the same time in Europe or Japan, where she does whisper to Coop in the lodge at the end of the second hour who killed her. It's like episode 15 or something like that. Yeah, you got a ways to go.
Oh, good.
What was the last thing that happened? What was the last thing that you... Where'd you leave off?
Well, fantastic. Where I left off was the... Icelandic singing group, the Icelanders, keeping him awake, have finally shut up, and he's received a note under his hotel room door, and then is he mugged? Or I forget what happened there, but right around there, so I had to pause it.
Is he not shot? I thought he gets...
Oh. Yes, he did get shot. Yeah,
yes. Exactly. So that's the cliffhanger at the end of season one.
Well, that's exactly where I ended it.
I will let you in on that. I will ruin one surprise for you. He doesn't die.
What?
Yeah. Ugh. He comes back for the new show, and he survives to be mayor of Portland on Portlandia. You cannot.
I know.
There is no way to tell me that those don't exist in the same universe. Quite frankly.
I know, right? Because it's like, oh, I see, like, I always thought he was playing it super dramatic, but there is a comedic element that is the mayor of Portlandia that is Twin Peaks. So I always thought it was like a dire, surreal, serious show, but there is elements of humor in there that surprises me, I must say, and holds up very well.
I want to talk about a whole bunch of movies. I am curious, though, about what you saw. I asked you this, teased this at the end of last week's show. What were you able to watch in terms of movies during your multiple 40-hour flights to and from Australia?
Well, funny you should ask. On the way over, I decided just to click on the sci-fi fantasy genre selection that is afforded at United Airlines, how they break up their movies. And I watched four, but one's unmemorable. So I saw in no particular order. I started with Passengers. Now, that's the long-range flight where Christopher Pratt wakes up by himself and a robot bartender, and then wakes up Jennifer Lawrence because he has a crush on her or her. I'm not even sure.
I know this. You might remember I said when I saw this film that if you don't start the movie with her waking up, there's no point in having the movie because we're doing this whole goddamn movie is waiting for her to find out. Nothing is meaningful. Yeah. We're just waiting for her to find out. And then it's what natural disaster will come along that will bring these two kids back together. Instead, why don't you have her wake up, wander the ship, and find that there's someone else awake? This weird standoffish guy named Chris Pratt. And then you've got a whole movie of exploration ahead of you. And the reveal that he woke her up is at the very end of the movie.
Exactly. And apparently somebody edited the movie to have that exact thing happen. And also ending it with Chris Pratt dying or not knowing what happens when he goes off into space. He cut that miraculous save.
Right. Yeah.
Spoiler alert. And then you're left with, oh, does she wake someone else up? It's a big question mark at the end. The way this guy recut the movie. So there's, you know, that movie could have been saved so many ways from Sunday. And instead, it just smells of executive panic or something. I don't know. I would like to hear the how did this get made version of that movie to hear what was the behind the scenes thinking and how that came to be.
And what that movie is even about. I mean, what's it about? Why did you want to make this?
Because you had special effects. It seemed like a lot of thought was put into, what is swimming like at zero gravity? You know, the pool scene where she drowns at zero gravity. It's like, oh, yeah, I guess it would be hard to swim in a swimming pool without gravity. That was the one thing that I thought was explored thoughtfully. And then you build a movie around that. So
But hats off to Michael Shannon. Not Michael Shannon. Michael Shannon's wonderful. Michael Sheen, who, of course, I used to be a big fan of a long time ago, before he really became a movie actor. But it's ironically his least mechanical performance in many years. And he's the android bartender. That's the joke there. So what else on the little sci-fi channel?
Well, then Arrival, of course, is the story
You finally saw it.
Yes, that took forever, but I finally saw it. And I was fascinated. I enjoyed the slow pacing and long, almost, I would say, French New Wave pauses in dialogue and thought. But then sort of a weird ender. I'm not going to lie to you there. I thought that was odd.
In what way? What would be the weird? See, I love that it's a movie about listening. That's what it's fundamentally about. It's that the gift of this alien culture coming to help us, to save us, so that someday we might save them is in their relationship to time, that we need to have a healthier relationship to time. And
right.
And how
Which
can
is why then,
well, this is the conversation that we have about The Truth Is Out There. So right. How do you make that movie and really express that theme without embodying a different relationship to time than any film that has come before?
Right. Which then seems like it's laboriously slow, but in fact, it's time jumping. That was the surprise.
Yes.
To me. Like,
yes.
How weird is that? I have to go back and go, this thing time jumped all over the place.
Right. So if your awareness of time is different and my awareness of the time, I forget when it was that I grokked to what was going on. But once I realized that, it stopped being slow because I realized I had been watching a different movie.
Right.
I'd been watching one with certain preconceived, all too linear constructs in my mind. And
absolutely. And to me, that jarringness, I don't know if it should have been telegraphed or marketed that this was a different relationship to time or something. But to me, then when I finally, as you said, got into it, then I was like, ah, damn it, it's too late. And I should have watched it again, knowing that.
Well, but that's it.
I had more
is I don't think they have to do anything differently. I think you just have to watch it again. In terms of marketing it differently, well, you know, I mean,
how much do you give away?
You know, the box it made $200 million here at the U.S. box office. So it was a huge hit and nominated for Best Picture. So. Could you? I'm amazed that it got made and marketed the way that it did. And I say, bully for them.
Huzzah!
Because it is a different movie. Sure. And they marketed it in a different way, and they had to. And one of the things that's starting to drive me nuts now, we're talking about television. You know, there's no two shows on television seem to have the same amount of episodes. None of them seem to drop at the same date. Their audiences all seem to find them in different ways, to different numbers, to different percentages of the audience, right? There's no set rule anymore in terms of episodic distribution. And and yet the film companies still seem to keep trying to find the methodology that is appropriate. They all acknowledge that the times they are a-changing, and boy, hasn't technology changed everything, and oh boy, that audience attention span is different. But what they don't seem to appreciate is we're beyond the days of any methodology. The methodology ought to be unique to each film.
Aha! Well, that's a whole nother bag of wax, isn't it? Well, so that you have to conceptually come up. And then here's the thing. If that product fails to find an audience, do you blame the methodology that was invented just for this product?
Well, I think that you probably hit the nail on the head. Nobody ever gets fired for saying no to something. People get fired for saying yes. And so you want to be able to hide behind all your data and all your methods that have worked in the past. And if they don't work, right. Well, then it just means that the movie didn't work. Or we're suddenly blaming Rotten Tomatoes because Rotten Tomatoes, after all those years of movies being critic-proof, we are suddenly at the point where none of them are. Where movies cost so much money that they need huge, huge four-quadrant audiences turning out en masse. And Rotten Tomatoes builds enough of a consensus that it can place enough of a dent in that four-quadrant audience that the movie maybe, and I'm looking at you, new Pirates of the Caribbean, maybe... Will, or Batman versus Superman, or Suicide Squad. You name the gigantic movie that had huge box office returns, but that barely, by the end of its worldwide run, broke even, and in fact, in a couple of those cases, may have just lost a little bit of money. We're at this crazy methodology where we're now blaming the critics. We're blaming the critics for the bad movie? they hurt that bad movie from making money. Well, but the movie was bad. How are we placing the blame there? And and at the same time, this crazy thing where all of film production seems to be going higher risk, but at the same time lower reward. Because what are we trying to do, left, right, and center? We're trying to manage that risk. We're trying to manage it and. And not only are we creatively screwing ourselves, but it turns out financially they're screwing themselves as well. And distribution methodologies is just another way that they're trying to manage that risk. I give you To Wit, a movie that you may not even know about yet. It's available. Uh-huh. It opened theaters, DVD, and Netflix streaming on the same day, this Wednesday, Okja.
Wow.
And this is from Bong Joon-ho, the wonderful director whose work we've loved in the past, did The Host, did Snowpiercer, did Mother, and just like Snowpiercer, here's a movie that opens up in multiple platforms the day it opens up theatrically. And, you know, I know that they left money on the table for Snowpiercer by not just giving it a theatrical opportunity. And the case behind that was that the Weinsteins got in a pissing match with the director, and so they, you know, they cut off their nose to spite their faces. The question was with this film Okja, and have you heard of this movie?
No. How's it even spelt?
O-K-J-A. It's the name of a super pig, of a genetically modified 10-year-old super pig whose best friend is a Korean girl whose grandfather is a high mountain farmer in Korea. And it's a science fiction film, and it deals with that pig being taken away from her to be brought to be declared the champion of this super pig competition being run by the Monsanto of the future. The film stars Tilda Swinton in a dual role, Jake Gyllenhaal, Lily Collins, Steven Yeun, Paul Dano, Giancarlo Esposito, and as the little girl, An Seo-hyun. And like every one of these movies that this guy makes, of course, it has a wonderful environmental, ecological conscience to it. It's got a really wicked, sly sense of humor, great satire, and it's a really weird movie. May not at work altogether as well as those other movies do, but it's certainly worth everybody's time. I think you'll enjoy great parts of it. What a wonderful role, especially for Paul Dano, to get to play as kind of the secret agent-ish head of the Animal Liberation Front. A terrorist group that's all hilarious. About freeing animals. But the movie, the question has been, you know, aren't they cutting into money, leaving money on the table by having Netflix, which acquired the rights at Cannes, having them stream this thing the same day it goes to theaters? And the answer is, how can we know? Because Netflix never reveals how they make their money. They never reveal their revenue stream. So we don't know. But I would say that unlike Snowpiercer, I'm not sure this movie has a big theatrical life, except insofar as it's getting a lot of press about how it deserves more of a theatrical life.
And, how ironic.
And so just because it's the same director and just because it's the same issue as his earlier film Snowpiercer, those movies are not the same. They probably do deserve to have different distribution strategies from each other, and that's with the same filmmaker. So if the same filmmaker has two movies, albeit both very, very good, but that deserve different distribution methodologies, then why are you applying the same distribution methodologies by movies that are made by different filmmakers?
Exactly. So, so to sum up, you think Okja is marketed incorrectly because the director...
I'm not talking about the marketing. I'm talking about the distribution now as different from it.
Okay.
I'm as not different. Sure. I don't think Okja is being marketed well. No, I don't. Whereas I think Snowpiercer was probably marketed pretty well. I just don't think it was distributed well. So I think everybody who saw the marketing said, yeah, this looks really good. And then it was like, well, how do I see it? Where is this thing?
Yeah, where
did
is
this
it?
Play?
Yeah, exactly.
Even though it had starred Chris Evans, for crying out loud, hot off Captain America. But we just live in this time where I feel like there's so many success stories and failures, all of which circle around this idea of, never mind the marketing now, Dean, each movie needs its own unique distribution strategy and platform.
Good Lord.
For example, I heard there was a theory about or a plan to make Get Out, Jordan Peele's horror film this year that's made well in excess of $100 million domestic and will probably not only get but deserve a Best Picture nomination this year, a horror film. And it was going to be released either day and date streaming or within 2 weeks it was going to be streaming. And finally, someone said, "Ah, you know what? Let's roll the dice and just give it an old-fashioned theatrical release." And because there's nothing like this movie, lo and behold, there was a huge audience for it. And it was given enough time in theaters to generate a lot of press, which then made it become something that people wanted to see and enjoy, to be something that everybody had to see because the cultural conversation was surrounding it. I maintain that one of my top movies of last year, Hell or High Water, the bank robbery heist movie starring Chris Pine and Ben Foster as the bank robber brothers and Jeff Bridges as the Texas Ranger hunting them down, a modern day Western. This movie had everything anybody could want in it. It had action. It had heists. It had comedy. It had rich character work. And it had as much to say about the socioeconomic status of so many Americans who've been overlooked by all of mainstream media, not just the movies. And this movie got a Best Picture nomination, and it topped out at about $20-something million. It was profitable enough for its distributor because it was a small distributor. But this is a movie, you know, all these big studios like Paramount, instead of spending $200 million making this movie, here's a thought. There are so many lesser-budgeted independent movies with big stars like Chris Pine and Jeff Bridges. How about this? Buy those movies. And yet they'll say, well, we don't know how to release art house movies. But that's my point. This was not an art house movie. This was a movie that nobody who went to see it was going to say, oh, you know, I wish it had cost $100 million. Everybody who went to see it would say, this movie's so much fun, and it has movie stars. So here's the thing. Take this movie that cost $15 million, pay the filmmakers $15 million, and then instead of spending $200 million on a movie with part six in front of it that has Johnny Depp as a drunken gay pirate, and put half that money in distributing and marketing this brilliant, fun movie that, by the way, in the 1970s would have been a huge box office hit.
And, right. But we're in an age of product locomotives. And without ancillary revenue streams, you can't take that kind of risk. This is now risk management of buying indie things and just trying to sell them up the river.
And yet, and yet we're at the point, and we've been here for a long time, that the profit margin is no greater and hasn't been for 20 years. It's been no greater than it was back in the 70s when they made a lot more movies on a lot smaller budget. The percentage of their profit margin has not grown at all, even as these huge worldwide grosses have gone up. So it never worked in terms of actually helping their bottom line. It's made these companies far more precarious to, you know, and vulnerable to collapse. Yeah. And it's meant that good movies that audiences might really enjoy, big audiences might enjoy. How was Snowpiercer not intended to be a big product? It is a product locomotive. It's literally set on a product locomotive. and yet most audiences, even if they heard about it, said, wait, did that play? So all of this needs to be rethought, but I'll get off my soapbox about that for now. And let me hear, please, what was the third sci-fi movie that you wanted to talk about on the flight?
That's the hilarious thing. Doctor Strange. It falls exactly into what we're talking about. It's, you know, a superhero action, you know, supposed to be, but good Lord, ham-fisted directing, I love Mr. I would not call myself a Cumberbatch, but I am a big fan of his work. And yet here as Doctor Strange, it's he's adrift in a green screen room, I take it, fighting for any sense of reality. And it's a tough haul.
I'll go one step further. I never want to see him in a lead role again. I'm not interested. And I was as big a fan as there was, but I think he's given up. I think he's given up. I think he's trying to do movie star performances when an acting performance is what was required. I mean, looking back, people underestimate just the acting work that Robert Downey Jr. did to make that first Iron Man fly and to launch the whole cinematic universe. And what was required and why they cast Cumberbatch was not because they were looking for a movie star, but because they were looking for an actor, and he did not deliver.
Well, but again, is that his fault? Does it fall squarely on his shoulders? I guess so. But it also, to me, there was pacing problems. And a lot of that I'm going to land on the director's shoulder more than his at this point.
All right. Yeah. And in the Marvel universe, I don't even know if you can blame the directors, though, because everything's so controlled by the producers, right? I mean, this is why.
Right, exactly.
This is why Joss Whedon leaves the Marvel universe and now he's over at the DC Cinematic Universe, which brings us to one of the movies we need to discuss, the hero movie that we really need in this era. If one can say that we do need hero movies, superhero movies, the one we needed is the one we got with Wonder Woman. And this movie, directed by Patty Jenkins, the highest grossing film ever directed by a woman, her first movie that she's been allowed to direct since Monster, won Oscars more than 10 years ago. She doesn't, but you know, your film won Oscars, but we've got men for these jobs over here. So anyway.
Well, and this is what we've been saying on the show forever, that how you can't believably have an action film with a male star anymore because of it has to be female lead. I remember I was a champion of Salt, which was
head of the curve.
Miss Jolie.
You were ahead of the curve on this.
And so we knew specifically that in today's political climate, a woman leading an action film is the only way to go.
You know, the word is that the Broccoli's, Albert Broccoli's family, that Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson, who continue to produce the James Bond films, that they are biding their time patiently, trying to wait out Daniel Craig so that he will reverse course and agree to do a fourth Bond film. And one of the things that they want to do while marketing it and launching it as his farewell is to set the stage for a James Bond cinematic universe. And that would be to take the 3 years in between these films and to fill them in with smaller films where the focus is on other characters in the Bond universe. And they think right now would be the time to do it, because in Naomi Harris, they have a wonderful actress capable of carrying movies, as she has done, to do a Miss Moneypenny standalone movie. And
totally.
She's the right actress. That's the right character. This is the right time to do that. Also, honestly, I think at the same time, you have Ralph Fiennes as M. What a wonderful film you can make focusing on him. Someone who probably was a field agent decades earlier, is a political figure now. It would be a more thoughtful, slower moving espionage movie, but that's the point. They can do these smaller character driven films within the universe and probably make a hell of a return on them, and continue to get great actors coming in and playing these roles because they know that they might get their own standalone film.
Right.
But I wanted
to see Q.
Yeah, well, that actor who plays Q, that young man, is really, really good. So that would be interesting. I don't think Wonder Woman's a brilliant film. It suffers from some of the third act flaws that other films do, although her turning point, you know, it's a movie that's about love, actually, truly about love, and I don't mean romantic love. It's about unconditional love and sacrifice and compassion, and at the same time, it's the first film in the DC cinematic universe to have a pleasing tone, though I would be quick to point out that tone is largely courtesy of Chris Pine and his performance. He knows how to carry these Daring Do movies while playing them for real, but without taking himself too seriously. And it is a breath of fresh air. And anyone who's seen the film will know that... He's left behind big shoes to fill in that regard. So without him, I'm not sure what they do. And I agree with Paige Branson, who was on our show a couple weeks ago, when I asked her, so does this point the way for how they can salvage the DC cinematic universe? And she said, no, Wonder Woman points the way to how they can make another really good Wonder Woman movie. And
that's fantastic.
And that's kind of how I felt. I'm disappointed by the villain in it, the de rigueur villain performance by Danny Houston, who seems to always play villains because there's something so believably sadistic about him, but there's never been anything believably interesting about him on screen. So I don't quite understand why, but it's nepotism. He's a Houston, for God's sake. Exactly. And then the other disappointing thing is to find that the female villain is played by the wonderful Spanish actress Elena Anaya, who starred in one of my favorite movies, The Skin I Live In. And hopefully she got well paid, because if this is all they're letting her do, it's a crying shame. But yes, I think the best kind of superhero movie we could hope for in this age. And I got to tell you, I think I may have seen my last superhero movie. At some point during it, I was glad that I was seeing it. I was glad that we had it. And I also realized I'm 48 years old. I don't know if I have enough hours left in me to see any more superhero movies. What's the point?
Well,
I was asking.
What is the point? I know. And yet, you know, I see this as the result of Comic-Con, frankly, that there suddenly was a giant comic book convention near enough to Hollywood that all these producers went, wait, 250,000 people showed up for what now? And swarmed in, bought up all sorts of properties, and now have to make good on those returns. So I think that this is a result of that, which I believe they mistakened, was that people really love comic books. In fact, what they love is dressing up and hanging out at the convention together. So that will need some re-examining in the future.
You know what else people love, I believe, because they keep making them, are these alien movies. And I was a fan-ish of Prometheus. I thought there are some really fun ideas in here. Some really nice performances, obviously, but some really fun ideas. And so when the ship blasted off at the end with Fassbinder and Naomi Rapace, I was going, okay, I bet a sequel could really be good. could really be good, because I felt like they were doing some of the machinations they were because, well, this has to be an alien movie. But clearly Ridley Scott had terrain, new terrain that he wanted to explore. So I felt like now with the sequel, with Prometheus having proven itself enough, he would really be free to explore the big ideas that I'm convinced he wants to explore. So I go to see Alien Covenant, and it's very clear he is really interested in very big ideas. He's also really interested in franchise box office. And so he slaps the name Alien on it, and so therefore he has to give us the thrills and the chills that we expect from an Alien movie, all of which we've seen before. So they're not thrilling and chilling anymore. It's just like watching a band play their greatest hits. And so halfway through the film, we jettison the big ideas and the interesting performances that go with it, especially Bad Billy Crudup. When was the last time I thought he was interesting in something? And but it's so disappointing, ultimately. In fact, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but about 20 minutes before the end of it, I said, you know, if I walk out of this movie now, I will have enjoyed myself. So I'm going to walk out now, because I knew where we were heading. There was nothing more interesting was going to happen. It was going to be about resolving the plot and setting up the next sequel. And I wrote down what was going to happen, and I left. And then I looked up on Wikipedia the plot, and I got it 95% right.
Wow, that's like a magic trick.
So
okay, stop the film. I've written down on this piece of paper.
Here's what's going to happen. Yeah. And I, and like I said, I really enjoyed seeing it, and I loved seeing it on the big screen, because there still really isn't anybody that creates a science fiction canvas like Ridley Scott. So it was wonderful to see it writ large on the big screen. But I enjoyed myself because I left early. And if I had stayed to the end, the feeling of disappointment would have crushed what had come before. Quickly, I saw two other movies that opened this weekend, both of which have a great deal of buzz behind them.
Of course.
The first is Edgar Wright's, I guess we can call it masterpiece, Baby Driver.
And yes.
This stars Ansel Elgort, Lily James, Kevin Spacey, John Hamm, the incredible Jamie Foxx. He's so good in this movie. The perfect first act to a heist film. You will not see a first act to a heist film any better than Baby Driver. And I think Edgar Wright, for the first time in his career, managed to... He absolutely accomplished perfectly everything he set out to do. It is a perfect movie. And as such, what I realize that means is it's also perfectly trapped inside the head of Edgar Wright, which is a place that after about 30, 45 minutes really gets boring.
Oh, no.
You might enjoy it. You might enjoy it. It's thrilling.
I might enjoy it.
I appreciate that the film gets relentlessly darker. Each act is an octave range deeper into the darkness. That it continues to pull story out of the main character, out of Baby, and his story is moving throughout. The young kid that I thought might be the weak point was very much the strength of this film. And at the same time, I wanted to see his life. I did not want to be trapped inside Edgar Wright's head of what is cool. And it is really a trick with heist films, because honestly, heist films often succumb to being way too heady, way too thought out.
Yes.
Much like the heists themselves have to be thought out. But the movies really desperately need some pulsing human life to them. And where Ansel Elgort's character was permitted to provide that, he does. But he can't overcome how much control over this material the director is wielding.
Oh, damn it.
Great reviews. I was really looking forward to that. I said, it is perfect. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely perfect. Right. So the contrast to this is I see Sofia Coppola's remake of The Beguiled. And for people who don't know, in 1971, Clint Eastwood stars in maybe his oddest movie ever, directed by Don Siegel, playing a Civil War soldier who's trapped behind enemy lines after being wounded, gets taken in by a seminary school for girls, and sexual tension and psychological slavery ensues. And it's a really, really weird movie. It's a really, very strange movie. Sofia Coppola wins Best Director this year at Cannes for doing a remake of it. That is a flawed movie and fascinating from beginning to end. And by the way, this Southern Gothic period is so perfect for Sofia Coppola. She's played around in other periods that I don't think fit her, but something about this Southern Gothic, these archetypal yearnings and these unspoken, unconscious drives that are always percolating just beneath the surface, is a really rich terrain for her. And it's a remarkably restrained work. About a quarter of the critics have not liked it because they've all said that it's too tame. I don't think that's the problem. I think the restraint is brilliant because it plays to the psychological violence that's bubbling underneath the surface. I think some of the casting choices were off, not the least of which is Colin Farrell, who at times has been very good. And it's not that he doesn't give a good performance, but Clint Eastwood, who was not the actor that Colin Farrell is, certainly at relative ages, but because of his iconic status, it brought so much more gray to this material. There was so much more shadows thematically, as opposed to what Colin Farrell is bringing to it. In the original, which is a much lesser movie, you're never quite sure about where maybe your alliances ought to be in terms of the characters. And in this, you're very sure until I had one moment at the end where I questioned, well, wait a minute, maybe I'm supposed to be sympathetic towards this character. So a flawed movie that is nevertheless at 94 minutes brisk and endlessly fascinating versus a two-hour perfectly constructed and executed movie by Edgar Wright that I wish I had walked out of after 30 minutes because I would have been raving to you about having seen one of the best movies of the year.
Wow. Damn it. Okay. Now I'm going to have to see both of these and get back to you. Hopefully they're on the plane.
Hopefully they're on the plane.
Next week.
Maybe you'll see Okja on the plane.
Oh, wouldn't that be good?
That would be
the one. I'm
going
to look for that.
Because if anybody loves a movie about genetically engineered pigs, especially the week when the farmer from Babe gets sent to jail, poor James Cromwell, it's Dean Haglund.
That's me.
That brings us to an end of a fun installment.
I had fun.
Of People's Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. They can find every installment of the show at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, hollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Write a review if you want.
What could be more fun? Like us on Facebook, won't you?
Please like us.
Facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. Can people follow us on Twitter and Instagram, Dean?
Holy smokes. And they can do it all with the same handle, which is at Dean and Phil. Spell it the word and.
Very exciting.
Get some great hashtag.
Yes, you do. And please write us as Maurice Terenzio did, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, or write us as you yourself would. You don't have to write us as he did. Make it original. Right. Make it new. Make it be what you want us to talk about. If we have anything to add and we find it interesting, we'll certainly share it with our listeners. After all, that's one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Until next week.
Absolutely.
I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.